Lots of coming and going in our life these days. I just returned from a really quick impromptu trip to Los Angeles with our two kiddos. Wow, it was something I've never done before, which is to like very short notice impulsively buy plane tickets, which I found I will have to brag about, from Minneapolis to LA for round trip nonstop for $215. So I was like, oh yes, we must go to the sun. So the kiddos didn't have school last Thursday and Friday. And so we hopped on a plane Wednesday night and went to the beach and went to Harry Potter World at Universal Studios. I saw some great friends and just had like a really nice little like mama son weekend together. We ate a lot of frozen yogurt and spent a lot of time at the beach.
Yeah, that looked awesome. I would have gone with you, but I had some stuff I had to take care of here. And it was just hashtag FOMO for me all weekend. Fear of missing out, for those who aren't hip to the jive.
Yeah, I think the other thing that you're not hip to the jive about is you haven't read all of the Harry Potters yet.
Yeah, so you really, all right.
You're not really entitled to Harry Potter World at this point.
They wouldn't have let me in to the park.
Yeah, there's a test.
And then I'm leaving in 2 days from now to go on my retreat. And the last retreat I had was in January, I think. And I know we tend to do one in June or July and then one in January. But with all the move and everything, the chaos that was going on, I didn't do that. So I'm heading 4 hours north of Minneapolis to Lake Superior. And I'm going to be doing some serious founder retreat thinking and strategizing and relaxing. To be honest, I feel like I need a break. Just having been going full speed since January and haven't taken, you know, much time off.
Yeah, this is really the first time that you've had much of a breather since the conversation about the acquisition began.
Yep.
And it's been sort of full throttle for you since then.
Yep. So this will be nice. It'll be nice to get away. And I'm going to take up my trusty copy of The Zen Founder Guide to Founder Retreats. If you haven't read that book, it's a book that Sherry wrote, an ebook about how to take founder retreats and how to structure them and what to do and what questions to ask yourself. And so I'll definitely be referring to that while I'm up there. I think it's $24? And folks can find the link to that at zenfounder.com in the upper right sidebar.
Hey, thanks for the plug.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
So I borrowed your phone and went for a run around Lake Calhoun. And my phone, of course, was dead. So I used yours. And while I was running, you kept getting like a ton of Slack notifications from Derek. And they were very like positive, excited Slack notifications. I didn't really like read them, but every time they came up, they would like interrupt my Spotify. So I had to like make them go away. So you want to like let me know why you're getting like lots and lots of gleeful messages from Derek today?
Yeah. So Friday, it's Monday today. And Friday, Derek and I had this major breakthrough on a problem that we had been fighting on and off two and a half years. It was just, it's a performance thing that happens as the database gets bigger and as more people use the app we work on. And we've always just taken a fairly linear approach to it. Like, let's add another database index. Let's increase the size of the database server and give it more horsepower. Let's rewrite this piece of code. We've realized in the past few weeks that we are getting close to hitting the logical like extent of that. You know, you can only optimize something so far. And so you have to take a different approach. And we've just been looking for a different approach. And the only different approach, kind of the one that most people use, is just this really painful, complicated, time-intensive thing that you do, and then you live with it forever after that. Once you make that choice, you can't go back. It's a restructuring of your database, in essence. And it's painful to do the first time, and then it makes everything more complicated. And so we have just been, you know, I've been agonizing over that choice, like really not wanting to do it. And Friday afternoon, we basically said, look, we need to pull the trigger on this, because, you know, it's months from now, we're going to really start seeing like a backup and performance issues, and we need to get ahead of it. And we kind of said, if we don't think of something better by Monday, we're going to start doing that thing that we don't want to do, the restructuring. And then we just sat there for, I don't know, it was like 90 minutes or 2 hours. And we just kept hammering on this problem. And again, we have thought about this over and over. We've researched it. We've done this stuff. But for some reason, in that 2 hour span, we basically solved it. Like, we fixed it. And this is like a 10x or 100x solution. Like, it's going to be 10 times or 100 times faster. It's crazy how much this will scale. This could literally scale us out for 5 years or 10 years. I mean, just some enormous amount of time. And that's what we've been going back and forth about. Texting over the weekend. We like talked about it on Saturday. That's what the Slacks were coming through, because now he's like working full force on this.
So you guys had this massive problem and thought that you were going to have to do this very complicated, very time intensive solution, but you sat with it for a couple hours, and it sounds like you batted it back and forth and really thought through all of these different options and scenarios, and like found this really novel, unexpected way to solve this problem, or way to strategize what to do. And now you're both like doing a little happy dance in your respective offices today.
Oh my gosh. You should see all these texts we've sent back and forth with the emojis. And then we just keep sending more and more ideas of how even this approach can be used in other areas of the app. Like, I feel like we just tapped something that is really big. It's a big deal. Like, that's all I can keep saying is like, this is a once a year, maybe twice a year type of breakthrough that you have, where it changes the game.
That's pretty awesome. Congratulations, by the way, to both you and Derek.
Thank you. It reminds me again of why I like working on products and working on technical stuff, because when you do solve a problem like this and it's an elegant solution and it works, it feels great. You know, it feels fantastic, but it was so painful to get here. Like, I wish it had been interesting if we could have thought of it 18 months ago or something.
Well, I think one of the like take home, like big ahas about this situation is that you really needed like the two of you, your combined brain power, to be able to solve this problem. Like, you've been thinking about it. He's been thinking about it. Obviously, you've talked about it before, but it was the extended time of just the two of you in a room really using your brains together that seems like it was the sort of the tipping point of helping this problem get solved. And it's a really like lovely argument for having a co-founder or having someone who is as mentally invested in solving whatever problem you're working on as you are.
It is. And I'm not sure what to say about that. I mean, I've been a single founder a bunch of times, and I know there's a lot of folks who listen to this who are single founders, and it's not a bad thing. There are pros and cons. But in this case, for these really hard problems, I have found that having Derek to collaborate on them with has made us, like, we make way better decisions and we come up with way better solutions than I think either of us could come up with individually. And the interesting thing is, like, we operate a little differently. Like, I throw out the ridiculous ideas and I do the big what ifs, and I'm just kind of trying to think super creatively in a way that, like, some things I say, Derek rolls his eyes and he's like, come on, we can't do that. You know, we can't just remove the entire page from the app, or we can't just load everything asynchronously. That would never work. And he's right. But I throw it out anyway. And then we follow a path, you know, we follow a path that eventually gets us to some, at least in this case, like a crazy, crazy good solution. And so I can't imagine trying to get to the solution that we did on my own. And I can't imagine Derek doing that either. I was throwing out the ideas and he basically would take them and apply them in like an engineering mindset. And it was totally a collaboration. I mean, I can talk about what parts each of us contributed, but it didn't matter because it wouldn't have happened without both of us there.
And it's not unlike some of the ways that we've tackled problems in our family, where we have a big problem or a big concern and we sort of sit and bat it around until we come to some new understanding or new arrangement. And I think maybe the conversation to sort of try to flesh out today in the next few minutes is how to solve problems well with other people, whether it's sort of a technical problem like you and Derek experienced, or whether it's deciding whether to move to Minnesota or not, or, you know, it's a family problem or a family question that you're trying to work through. It seems like there's some common ingredients that make those conversations either go well or not be as effective as they maybe could be.
Yep, I agree. And I think we've listed out six here, kind of six tactics or six strategies for solving big, complex problems. And the first one is to have a co-founder or a collaborator on that. And, you know, I think that you can solve big problems on your own, but I think it's going to be so much easier. And I think you're going to get to the better end result if you do have that person that you're collaborating with.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, I think, to some extent. Like, some people do better solving problems by thinking about them on their own, or maybe some problems are better solved in that manner. But at some point, you have to bring that potential solution back around for some sort of some testing or some QA to make sure that the assumptions that you have used in your solution to the problem really hold up against the perspective of another person. But I think one of the things that is really important in having these kind of key conversations or these problem solving conversations is to really make sure that there is dedicated set aside time that's not distracted, where you can really focus on this problem as long as you need to. I remember us having conversations where we sort of set it on the calendar and said, okay, this is the day that we're really going to talk about whether or not we're going to put moving on the table in the sale of Drip, or whether or not we're going to homeschool or send our kids to school this year, you know. And those kinds of conversations require potentially extended amounts of time that get derailed by any kind of interruption. So it's like phones off, door closed, kids are asleep or out of the house or busy or doing something. And it's this set aside time where that is what we're doing. There's no sort of tangents and there's no disruptions allowed.
Yeah, that's important because you have to get into flow, right? You need to get into the zone to where the problem is just so, I don't know, it's in your head where you're holding the whole thing in memory, and both of you need to do this, you know, if you're working with someone else on it. And so it might take some time. It's not going to be something you're going to think about for 10 or 15 minutes and likely come up with a solution. And if you get interrupted, you lose that, like it goes away. And so, you know, who knows, that focus time, maybe it's an hour and maybe it's 2 or 3 hours, but having that time to really chew on it. And then there's one other piece. It's like being okay, if you really are trying to think about stuff, being okay with there being some silence in the room. And I realize that a lot of times, you know, can you imagine like going into a meeting, calling a meeting to solve a problem, and it's 3 or 4 coworkers and you're sitting around there, and as you guys are all thinking of solutions, there's just silence for 2 minutes or 3 minutes. Like, it would be super awkward, right? Unless everyone knows that that's okay. And everyone's like thinking about the problem equally as hard. And that's what I found with folks who I'm able to collaborate with, like yourself and like Derek, is there's a comfort level where if we just sit there in silence, it's not awkward because we've done it before. And we know that that silence means I'm thinking hard and so are you. And you can often tell by the person's, you learn their thinking body language, you learn their thinking expressions, you learn that their facial expressions, you learn that some folks like to walk around and or lie down while they're thinking, you know, it's funny to kind of see that. But so I think having focused time and then also just being comfortable enough that you can sit in silence and think through, give yourself time to both talk through, but also think through the ideas.
Which is also like especially important for introverts. We talked a couple of weeks ago about extroversion and introversion. And I think silence and having the space within a conversation to let the internal juices sort of marinate is super important for those of us who are a little more oriented toward introversion. So one of the other things that we jotted down when we were reflecting on your breakthrough with Derek and in some of the problem-solving conversations that you and I have had is this idea of persistence, of deciding not to get frustrated by all of the rabbit holes and like just letting it be okay to keep sort of hacking away at it and knowing that it's going to take a while. So I guess realizing that if you're 45 minutes into a conversation and you still feel like you don't have much traction or a well-formulated possible solution, letting that be fine and letting it be sort of known that big problems take a long time to solve. So really creating the space and that set aside time and the patience within yourself to be persistent and just to keep at it and keep at the conversation until such a time as it's clear you either need to take a break and return to it at a different time or until that really juicy solution presents itself.
Yeah. And I think the reason you need persistence is that A, it's a hard problem, so it's probably not going to come easy. But B, I find that just the sheer number of ideas you can throw at a problem allows you to view that problem from different angles and completely different approaches. And so the problem we were trying to solve, first, we looked at it from the user interface. Can we limit something there? Second, we looked at it from the database. Can we improve the database performance or restructure, denormalize? Can we look at the code and do it? And but those were all coming through just by crazy ideas that we were throwing out about ways to change things. And, you know, we weren't necessarily thinking logically about the brainstorming of the ideas, but we were then taking each idea and applying it like in a technical sense. it's like, does this work? Because it has to work eventually. But there was a level of trust. And I think this is the next item on our list. There was trust in the room that I could throw out an idea that was completely preposterous. And I knew that I would not be judged, right? Derek was not going to judge me for a ridiculous idea. He might roll his eyes, but then I would laugh. And then we'd say, oh, we totally can't do that. But then that would often lead us down this path towards an extension of that idea or a variation of it. And having that trust in the room and being able to just throw out whatever I thought could feasibly work, I would often preface it with, well, I know we would never do this, but hear me out. And then I would throw out the idea.
I think that's really important to highlight because when we talk about solving problems, particularly in a work or entrepreneurial context, I think we're thinking about like sort of the smart strategies. And there's a lot of focus on sort of the cognitive process and the intellect. And it's easy to forget the sort of emotional ingredients that go into making problem solving successful. And so this idea of trust or this focus on trust really allows the space for creativity. And without trust in this kind of a conversation, I think people hold back. I think people aren't brave enough to throw out that really outlandish, we would never do this kind of idea, because they don't feel safe, or they realize that there's this potential that they're going to be seen as stupid or even be sort of mocked in someone's head for the idea that they brought forth. So the emotional quality of this kind of conversation is as important, I think, as the smart brains that are involved. Without trust and sort of this solid sense of connection, it's really hard to do this kind of problem-solving work.
I agree, because I think if you feel like you're going to be judged, that you will mentally shut ideas down before they come out of your mouth. And those ideas could turn into the ultimate solution, which is typically what winds up happening, right? A kind of a semi-outlandish thing gets refined and refined again and refined again until suddenly you stumble upon something that's not so outlandish and that actually may be the right answer.
I think one of the other things that was really helpful in, you know, this problem solving experience you had with Derek was the lack of ego that both of you brought to the conversation. There was like no shame in not knowing, in not being able to solve this problem. You were working on it together, but nobody was sort of upset or flustered or all bent out of shape about this problem besting you to this point. And I think that lack of ego also facilitates trust. It says, hey, I'm humble enough to realize like, I don't know how to do this and I can't do it by myself. So I need you, this other person, to help to work together with me so that we can come to this place of greater understanding than we could do by ourselves.
I think that's a really good point. I think if there's one thing that we did well in building the Drip team, you know, especially the folks who we were collaborating with often, like in Fresno, is that since Derek and I tend to want to find the best solution to stuff and we don't tend to tie our ego to being the one that came up with that solution, we hired a bunch of people who felt the same way. Like, we probably did it pretty intentionally. We looked at a lot of personality and such, but we would be in a room and there'd be four of us or five of us and there'd be kind of a hard problem and everyone would stand up and throw ideas in and we would just take the best ideas. It was never who thought of that. Your idea has more merit. Often my ideas originally were the most preposterous ones and wound up being the ones we'd throw out, but others in the room would then build on those. And I think having a lack of ego and not caring, like, who cares who solved this problem as long as we solve it, you know, together. And that's a big thing I've seen at previous jobs where I'm working on teams, is that often, let's say the manager's ideas will be given more credence, or, you know, the manager has the ego, or someone on the team may have the ego and they really want their solution, not because it's the best one, but because it's theirs. And they will sit and argue for that one. And I think it can be really catastrophic or toxic, however you want to say, towards this process of finding the best solution to a problem.
Well, it's the opposite of collaboration. I mean, when you're collaborating on a problem, the we solves it, the plural entity solves it. And when you try to parse out who did what and when and who gets what credit, it's totally antithetical to what it means to be collaborative, to sort of knit together your abilities and your intellect and your creativity to try to produce something different. So if there's any kind of competition or elbowing each other to see who's best or who contributed most to solving the problem, that totally goes against any of the value that you get from a real collaborative process.
I think the next thing that we did pretty well was to take a step-by-step evaluation of each potential solution as we threw it out there. And so, like I said, you're often like kind of throwing darts, and maybe you're deciding whether to homeschool or not. Maybe you're deciding where to live next, what city, and maybe you're solving a technical problem or an interpersonal problem. But throwing out ideas and being able to then look at them without judgment and figure out why they will or won't work, and then figuring out, well, if it won't work, what can we do to fix that about this idea? and really just run through evaluation, I think is the best phrase for that. I mean, that was a big part of what we were doing. We didn't just throw out a bunch of ideas and have them, I don't know, be up on a whiteboard or in a text file or something and never not follow each of them to its logical extent, because that was important. It took us going down, you know, maybe 20 different ideas, and one of them made a turn at a certain point when we said, well, it won't work because of this. And then I think Derek said, if we did that, it sounds very similar to what, you know, this other solution that I've heard about, but that would never work in this instant. And he totally and we locked eyes and we were like, oh, that was it. And so it just, you know, if we'd just thrown out the ideas and been like, you know, none of these seem like they work, that wouldn't have been enough, right? We really dug into each one and looked at why don't they work and talked it through, and then tried to counter why each of them didn't work and really tried to make each of them work, continuing to throw out like creative solutions as we went.
Yeah, that's sort of the difference between what you did in like brainstorming, as it's sort of popularly thought of. You didn't just throw out a bunch of ideas, or maybe you did and then you wrote them down, but each one you came back to and weighed carefully with this sort of step-by-step evaluation of why won't this work? How could we tweak it to make it work? What components need to be in place for it to work? That seems like a really important thing. I think the last reflection on this experience that I jotted down as I heard you talk about it is this, you know, determination to see it through. And I guess we already spoke about persistence, and they're certainly analogous, but I think just not giving up on a hard problem. And you sort of had one solution on the table, this rewriting solution that you knew was going to be tons of hours and development time, and you weren't excited about it, but you could have done it that way. But having the time and space and taking the time, even over the weekend, to really tinker with the idea, refine the solution, and really see it through. And it's being built right now as we speak.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a big part of it. It was just the refusal, really not wanting to do the long, hard months of making the app more complex, and just, you know, kind of the refusal to accept that as a reality, I think was a big part of it. And then even once we arrived at the solution that we are going to use, we were just a few minutes in and Derek said, but you know, this won't work because of this certain type of rule people can create. And then it was like, that was just as far as I'm concerned, just a reason to figure out how to make that work. And so then outlandishly, let's just create another table then and put a bunch of stuff in there and then run a cron. And it was just like, oh, we'd never do that. But then again, that was the solution to a small piece of why the broader solution wouldn't work. And we just kept taking it from there. And by that point, it was like, man, this thing might really have legs.
I think there's this unique satisfaction in this kind of collaborative problem solving. It's like a win for the team. It's really satisfying for both of you, or for you and I when we're chewing on a problem, to go through this process and begin a conversation at a point of not knowing. And ideally, it doesn't always work this neatly, but like after a couple hours, end a conversation with a game plan. And again, this importance of setting aside focused time, of allowing silence, of deciding to be persistent, of having a conversation with the framework of trust and not having egos in the room. And then this sense of step-by-step evaluating each potential, kind of without too much emotion, without too much entanglement, but really thinking it through logically. Those seem to be the strategies that have helped collaborative problem solving be successful up to this point. Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.